You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hey, it's Paul Q. Coldery, and you're listening to Whatever Nevermind.
I'd like to welcome to the program Paul Coldery, or Paul Q. Coldery. I just fucked it up, didn't I? It's Coldery.
No, Coldery.
God damn it. I started mind-fucking myself there. One more introduction, and I'll get it. Coldery. All right. I'd like to welcome to the program producer Paul Q. Coldery, producer of the whole record that we're going to be talking about today. Paul, how are you this evening?
I'm good, and let me note at the beginning that I produced this album with Sean Slade.
Right, I planned on getting into that a little bit, but but before we get into that, there is something heavy I need to hit you with. I think the people need to know, what does the Q stand for?
Quick. My middle name is Quick.
Quick? I like the way you signed off on your email, PDQ or PQ,
PQK.
PQK. God, I'm all over the place today. I thought that was neat. So is it seriously? Is that like a kind of a joke that you use professionally?
No, it's my mother's maiden name. My grandfather was Dr. William J. Quick of Muncie, Indiana.
It's truly Quick. All right. Well, do you record quickly?
I do actually record pretty quickly. I'm certainly not known for taking too much time.
All right. Well, before we get into the record that we're talking about today, tell us a little bit about your background then. I just heard in the little pre-conversation that you have a little bit of a Minnesota tie, and your parents are still living, I don't know, it sounds like about 2 miles from where I'm at right now. What got you into music and basically kind of eventually into production?
Well, I played in bands in high school, and we were obsessed with rock music, and at that point, rock music was the culture, you know? So, I studied things in school, but I was much more obsessed with trying to figure out how to fix my bass guitar. And, you know, I'm kind of a tinkerer. So I learned about electronics, and I didn't do any recording really in high school. I didn't do much of that till I got even through college. But, I was always playing in bands, and it was kind of a social thing. And, you know, I was just always in that world, and I kind of gravitated toward it. The farther I got, the more I realized that producing and making records kind of combined everything I like to do. Well, technically, anyway.
So any schooling did you go to as far as that, or did you just kind of get in there and start tinkering your way up the ladder?
No, you don't really need to go to school to learn rock and roll.
No, the recording part. The recording part.
No, it's... like I said, I had a technical background from the beginning, and it's not rocket science. You know, it's it's an intuitive art, and it's there's some technical stuff involved, but you know, it's not that much different from driving a car. You know, you're driving an expensive, impressive piece of machinery, but I didn't build it. You know, I just know how to drive it.
All right. I think it's a little more complicated than driving a car, but I think I get the analogy though. Yeah. Yeah.
Flying a plane. Let's say that flying a plane.
All right. Fair enough.
You know, cause it's something a normal person can't do perhaps unless you've done it, but you know, you're going to, once you learn it, you know, the skills translate across different planes and, right. You know, all right, there you go.
Well, you mentioned you played bass. Do you play any other instruments?
I play a little bit of almost everything just because, you know, you end up doing this and that and the other thing, and I have instruments around the house. I like stringed instruments, and I like to play all kinds of different, especially weird ones like little four-string guitars and stuff. But, you know, guitar basically, bass professionally more than anything else. But
okay. And you mentioned that kind of, you know, in the high school years, you're focused on rock. Who are your, like, who are the big artists for you as far as drawing you into music?
Well, you know, Get Your Ya-Ya's Out by the Rolling Stones was huge. The first record I ever bought was Abbey Road, like the day it came out. So that kind of shows you what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, but you know, not just classic rock. I mean, by high school, you know, I was pretty much of a proto metal guy, you know, like Deep Purple and Uriah Heep was a favorite. Grand Funk Railroad were pretty big in my high school. The Allman Brothers, though, you know, liked them too.
Okay.
My high school band played a lot of Allman Brothers.
Nice.
It was fun.
I don't doubt it. As a producer, is there an artist that who would be the artist that you never produced that you'd want to?
Iggy Pop.
Really? That was quick. You've apparently had that lined up, huh?
Sean and I used to get asked that, and we kind of always said that. And I think it's, I don't know if it's still true because, you know, obviously I don't know what he feels like doing these days. But back in the day, there was a moment where we, you know, like around the time Don Was made that album with him with Wild One and stuff. That was, you know, Brick by Brick, wasn't there one? Wasn't they called that? The one where he had a kind of a hit with Kate Pearson.
Yeah.
I mean, Iggy was a viable recording artist for quite a long time. So
absolutely,
know,
yeah.
We tried, but you know, you can't always get what you want.
Stones. Well, you mentioned Sean Slade there right at the beginning. So you guys did a lot of work together, correct?
We did, and he doesn't produce much anymore. He's a professor at Berklee School of Music. And he tells kids about the wrong way to produce records, which is kind of the right way. But we were best friends in college, and we got together after college and realized that we have a good combination of skill. We had a good combination of skills.
There we go.
We were a good team. And it was a lot more fun to travel around together and do things together than just going your own, you know?
Well, tell me a bit like how you ended up getting the whole project then. Was it something that you kind of pursued or vice versa?
No. I got a call one day from Butch Vig's manager, and who I didn't know. Her name was Shannon, and she said, I did you a favor today. And I said, okay. And I said, are you going to tell me what it is? And she said, no, you'll find out. And so they had a meeting, you know, my understanding is Kurt and Courtney met with Butch Vig and his team, you know, about producing Courtney's record, because obviously Butch had done so well for Nirvana. And he said that he had just, you know, finished something and he wanted to start a band, which I guess became Garbage.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, he didn't want to do it. So he begged off, and they said, well, who should do it then? And I think my understanding was he said, you should get the guys that did Creep, the Radiohead song, you know? Mm. And Kurt said, oh, I like that song. And it turned out that the Geffen A&R man was Mark Cates, who had been a Boston guy that we knew. And he basically raised his hand and said, I know those guys. I can call them up. And so we did. And, you know, that wasn't they didn't give us the job right then, but that's how we kind of got on the screen, you know?
How the door was opened, I guess.
Yeah. And then, you know, we had a conversation. We had a phone conversation with Courtney and somebody else that was in the running and probably maybe had a little better position than us, took themselves out of the picture in the negotiation process, I guess.
You care to say who it was?
No, I shouldn't say.
Okay.
It doesn't matter. You know, and so we ended up getting the job for those reasons, I guess. You know, there was some discussion of how to, we were trying to find the right kind of studio. And so we ended up down in Atlanta because they had the combination of gear that that Courtney was looking for, Kurt and Courtney were looking for. And they, Butch had done Siamese Dream. Down there in Atlanta. And so we that was the same studio.
Well, I guess that clears that up. I was going to ask you how that was chosen, but that was largely because of, you mentioned gear, but like, was the fact that Siamese Dream was recorded there, did that actually play a role in the decision? Do you know?
I think that Courtney was friends with Billy Corgan.
Yeah, they're more than friends.
Well, that's not for me to say. Yeah. Okay. And she called him up and said, you know, she wanted a Neve console and Studer chip recorders, which at the time were, you know, the top of the line. And and this studio had it, you know, they had the gear. It was a weird studio, but that was okay. I guess that probably helped things in a way. Everybody, you know, I think she wanted everybody to be out of their element too. You know, she didn't want to do it in Seattle. She didn't want to do it in Boston, you know. And so we were all, you know, in Atlanta where none of us really had any friends, really.
Yeah, okay.
You know.
Do you like that kind of setup, or you prefer something different? I mean, is that do you think that was a good decision, I guess, is all I'm getting at?
It was all right. It makes you focus a little bit more. I mean, you know, obviously it's better if you're just, you know, if you're just sort of away from home working on a record and you don't have to, you know, you're not seeing your friends, you don't have to feed your dog or whatever, you know, you can just kind of focus. I would get up and go running every day down by the Chattahoochee and kind of focus a little bit. You know, I mean, it was fine. Atlanta is a weird city and it's, you know, I drove around and checked it out a little bit, but when you're working on a record, a lot of times you're pretty much just working on a record. It's like being on an ocean voyage or something, you know? You're not really aware of your surroundings. There's not much around you. You're just on the boat with the same people every day, you know?
Right. So, did you ever run into Alan Jackson around the Chattahoochee?
I thought about him a lot, you know? the interesting thing there is that I noticed that women would go, you know, jogging along the river in full makeup, you know, like it's Georgia.
It's something that song made more sense, huh?
Yeah, the whole thing. Exactly. It didn't make more sense.
I read about this shit, you know, too.
But, and you know, we didn't, I don't think we went out once. We'd go out to, you know, get a burger or something, but you know, we were kind of out, the studios was out in this suburban area that really wasn't in the center of town either. So, there wasn't much around. You couldn't walk anywhere. You had to get in your car and drive to Fuddruckers, you know?
Yeah,
Fuddruckers, the greatest hot dog.
I've never had their hot dog. I've always gone with the burger. Is it a good hot dog?
You know, it's pretty good. It's kind of giant size.
Now, there's still one in Edina, which you did not live in. That's the last one here in the Twin Cities. But, yeah, the last producer I talked to was Steve Albini, and he produced In Utero in, I don't know, are you familiar with where Cannon Falls is here in Minnesota? Oh, I'm sorry if you're talking. I'm not hearing nothing.
Hey, how's that?
That's good. Okay.
This is what happens. You get to talk for a few minutes, and then it just drops you.
Oh, I mean, I'm sorry.
No, it's not your fault.
Okay. All I was saying is, I don't know how much of that you heard. I talked to Steve Albini and they produced, In Utero in Cannon Falls, just outside the Twin Cities here, at Pachyderm.
Right.
And that is very much getting, I mean, that's not even really a suburb of the metro here. So, was very much getting away from everything.
Yeah, it is for sure. I mean, it's all the same though. I mean, That studio is still going, but not run by the same people, I think.
Yeah, I think it even has a different name, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I think it does. But they still have, they kind of still, like in the lobby or whatever, kind of try to dress up some of the history of it.
Sure. No, indeed. No, Atlanta was, I don't remember too much about it, except that they had this weird deal where on Sunday you couldn't buy liquor, but on Sunday at midnight it turns into Monday and you can. So people would be waiting in the parking lot for it to turn to midnight, and so you could buy booze, you know, in the grocery store and stuff.
And my kind of town.
Yeah. Kinda.
Well, as a producer, how do you approach stuff? Are you and Sean together? However you want to phrase that. But do you like to, like, get in there and kind of shape it and make a record that represents you? Or do you want to try to, like, craft something for the artist based on what they want?
Well, I'll be specific about that record.
Yeah.
You know, we heard there were some demos. I have no idea who did them. And they were great. I mean, you could hear instantly that they were great, you know, like,
yeah, okay.
I was like, this is great. And so we went to Seattle and hung out for a few days and did pre-production. You know, we went to the rehearsal studio. Courtney didn't go, but we went to the rehearsal studio with the band and kind of worked with the Patty and checked out what everyone kind of sounded like and what the gear was like and talked about how we're going to do it. And then we all met at the studio. I think we had a day of rehearsal before the studio too, or maybe two. And then we went to the studio and just sort of set up and started playing as a band, which we normally do, you know. And then you build on that, you know, replace things, build things, edit things up from there. But you know, a band like that, they were a good band. You got to start with the band, you know. A lot of the stuff, you know, there's certainly some of Courtney's vocals that came from those live takes.
Oh, you know, on the final album?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, like any, a lot of rock things, they, you know, they happen the first time, and then they don't necessarily happen.
I do know that,
yeah. For a while, you know. And so you gotta always try to capture anything you can and use it, you know. You know, something like a scream or something like that. It's got to be spontaneous. It's got to be, it can't be like done, you know, after you do it 10 times, you know, you can't, it doesn't have the same vibe. So, you know, we try to get things on the first take if we can, or, you know, use bits from that were good from it, you know.
For sure.
You know, a lot of times on the first take, there'll be something that's great, but then there'll be something that's crap. So, you know, you just got to keep piling up the great things.
Prepping for this, it dawned on me that I knew who Courtney Love was before I knew who Hole was, and largely because of, you know, because Nirvana was just gigantic, and the fact that, you know, yep. Kurt and them were dating, engaged, and then married and all that stuff. The point I'm getting at is, like, how familiar were you with Hole when you got hired for this?
I had heard their first record that Kim Gordon, I think, produced, or Kim and was it only her? Anyway, that Pretty on the Inside.
Yeah.
And I thought it was good, it didn't really occur to me that I would do the next one. But I just remember thinking, like, you know, maybe that's just a little too messy, you know, too punky, you know. And I think, you know, Nirvana kind of had the same thing, you know. They started out pretty wild and punky, and they, you know, when they made Nevermind, I mean, Kurt said something like, you know, it sounds like Journey. Yeah.
I don't think him and I hear Journey the same way.
But exactly. But you know, it broke through to a lot of people, and I think that she realized after the first record that she needed to make a record that was cleaned up a little bit, you know, not completely, but considerably from the first one.
Now Kurt does sing backup on a song or two or something like that. Was he in the studio a lot, or?
No.
Okay.
He was on tour, they had a break, and he came to visit for a couple days after we had done basic tracks. We had the drums.
Okay.
He had us play the tracks, and he said, "I love the drum sound. You know, sounds good. I like what you're doing. but it was too soon to really judge the songs. And then she had him, there was a session where she had him attempt to sing some harmonies, but you could tell, I mean, people say, did Kurt write the songs? But, you know, he didn't know them. You know, she took him into the room and said, sing along on this song. And he said, I don't know this. I don't know it. You know, play it for me. And so, you know, if he'd written them, I assume he would have known them. So there's a few little scraps of, once again, you know, he did a few good things and we kept them and kept him in there. But there was no real attempt to have him sing back up on the record or anything. Courtney was, you have to understand, she was very territorial about her band, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't going to have Kurt come and sing on her record and steal the spotlight, you know. I mean, any more than Kurt was going to have her sing back up on In Utero, you know. So
sure. The guitar player, is it Eric Erlandson? I just don't know if I had his last name right there. It's very, you know, I should know it because it's very Midwestern here, northern Midwest anyway. But yeah, he mentioned in an interview with Spin Magazine some of the, that Courtney brought a little bit of a competitive approach to the fact that she was recording a record and wanted to beat Nirvana Nevermind in a way, you know, in the competitive sense, I should say. So
yeah, I don't think anyone thought that was going to happen, but it was clear that she was trying to make a record that people would hear,
Okay.
I'm not going to say there were any sales goals, but you know, obviously anytime you make a record you want people to hear it, and that one we managed to make that happen, I think. So
I absolutely now, I wasn't sure. I was going to bring it up, but I wasn't going to bring it up, the whole did Kurt write the songs thing. I mainly wanted to bring it up in the sense of, like, it's been debunked pretty much across the board. Because there really is almost a mythos, and maybe we'll tie into it a little later, that comes with the timing of the release and some other stuff. But back to the record a bit. And just one more question about Kurt then. So he was there for a couple of days. Did you have any, like, I don't know, personal conversations with him or things? I mean, you mentioned he talked about the record a little bit, but it being a little early. Any memories is really all I'm getting at there.
Sean bought him a pizza.
What kind?
Pepperoni.
Just straight up pepperoni, cheese, and sauce?
But then he has stomach problems, you know, so he ordered a pizza and he took a bite or two, but he couldn't really eat it. But I think we were afraid to finish his pizza. We're like, I don't know, what should we do? We had conversations, you know, a lot of guys in the studio, if you don't know each other that well, you can talk about the gear. You know,
yeah.
So we talked about this and that guitar and this and that buzz pedal and, you know, how did we mic the drums and, you know, stuff like that. He was very interested in our tech. And so we talked about them a bit. You know, we don't have particularly complicated techniques. I think in a way he was kind of, I think he thought we would do, we'd have more tricks, you know, and really the trick is just to be good, you know. That's the best trick.
He doesn't seem like a guy who'd be a big gearhead, was he?
Well, you know, he just was interested in what our choices.
Okay.
Were, you know, he wasn't like a nerd. But in fact, you know, I had, you know, you have this weird, it's sort of like an out of body experience. You know, I walked in the morning and there's, at the time, he was unarguably the biggest rock star in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, there he is. So you gotta, you know, you gotta just talk like a normal person. You gotta put that aside and just, you know, talk politics or anything. You know, they were over touring in Europe and he called during the mixing and wanted us to hold the phone up. And, you know, you gotta remember it was 1993.
Right.
You know? So no cell phones, no, you know, no computers really. I mean, the studio was completely analog. You know, no computer mixing, no Pro Tools. I mean, parts of Nevermind were done on Pro Tools in a very, very sort of primitive Pro Tools. set up, like, relatively primitive. I don't mean to insult anybody.
No, that would have been very early in Pro Tools, like, existence, correct?
Yeah, really. And we weren't on the whole record. We were not using it at all. So, you know, and that was the way you made records in 1993. So it was a different world. It really was. You know, like I said, we couldn't send Kurt a mix on the internet. We had to literally hold up the phone.
Right. A landline, yeah. Too, probably, right?
Yeah, and he was in Italy. So, you know, it was, I mean, I didn't mind it then. It was a little more magical, you know, because not everyone knew how to do it, you know. It's like you speak a certain kind of language, and you know now everyone speaks that language, and so it's not so special anymore.
Yeah, I get it. I'm recording you on a Pro Tools setup. If that helps shatter.
Oh no, I use it. I'm not like Albini. You know, I'm not an analog purist at all.
Oh no, I meant literally you were saying anybody now can do it. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, everyone does. I mean, more than anything now, I mix records by people who've recorded them at home and don't know how to finish them.
Yeah. Well, Courtney seems like someone who kind of like almost thrives in chaos. What was the band like in the studio? How did they interact with each other?
I think that's a very good way to put it. Okay. What you said. And, you know, it was genuinely chaotic. You didn't know who was going to show up when or what was going to happen or what kind of mood they were going to be in. But by and large, we were used to that. You know, so it wasn't anything that I hadn't encountered with other people, you know, and I think that Courtney respected us enough to know that, you know, if we were going to be the people that made the record, she couldn't really mess with us too much, you know.
You sure?
She left us alone and let us do things. And if she didn't like
them, so you're saying the drama was largely internally with the band and not directed at you guys, you and Sean.
Correct.
Okay.
I would say that's correct. You know, they had various kinds of volatile relationships, and that, you know, everyone had good days and bad days. But we, like I said, I mean, all rock bands are like that, really. So,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't like, oh my God, what am I going to do? This so and so's in a bad mood. You know, it's like, it's fine. You know, and that's another thing where it helps to be there were two of us. Me and Sean, because you know, you need an ally. If it's just you against the band, that's a little tougher.
That's a good point. I never thought about that.
Yeah,
there aren't a lot of production duos. The one off the top of my head is Kenny Kirtner and Richie Wise, because they produced a couple Kiss records. I'm not sure how much they carried it on after that.
Yeah, that was more of an old school thing. The closest analog to what we were doing were those guys Rothrock and Schnapps.
Oh.
Rob Schnapps, he's in L.A. You know, they had a team, and they did some great records. And I got to know Rob a little bit when I was working on a record out in L.A. at a studio right next to his. And, you know, good guy. He had a lot of similar experiences to me along the road. So
cool.
But, there were some teams like that. I thought one of the reasons we did it, though, was just to be a little different, I think.
Well, is there any type of blow up within the band that we can, like, in the sense of, like, I'm not looking so much for dirt, more the kind of story that, like, we can laugh about it now kind of moment. Was there anything like that where it seemed really serious, but it was something really stupid that blew out of proportion?
No, I don't think there's anything really, like, I don't really have any good fight stories. Mm. You know, one thing I will say was that Kristen, who played bass, was a fantastic musician, and I thought it was really a shame that she wasn't able to continue with the band because of overdosing. And
right.
I don't know much about what happened there, but she was someone who had a hard time in that environment. She wasn't the toughest-skinned person, and so I thought it was a real shame what happened to her, because she was really talented and she's one of the people that made that record great.
Well, let me just do a blanket question then. Look, we know Courtney and Kurt's deal with certain drugs. Were drugs an issue while recording this at all?
No, no. Like I said, all rock bands have various, you know, issues in that area.
Okay.
And, you know, it's just something you got to deal with. Like you said, what's our mood today? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it hungover? Is it, you know? But one of the things, like you said, like we said about being in a foreign city, you know, nobody was getting, I was getting into too much trouble that I could see, you know? Mm. So,
nobody was getting crazy at Fuddruckers?
No, I don't know, you know. I mean, we only went out to eat with Courtney maybe one time. Mm. And that was kind of nutty.
Oh, so, tell me a little bit about that. Come on, you just give me some little story there. I'm not really looking for dirt, just something kind of fun.
Well, you know, if she wanted to order something, she would just, you know, yell at the waitress and, you know, I mean, I remember we were in this restaurant, like a kind of a rock cafe sort of restaurant.
Okay.
And In Utero had just come out, right? So they were playing Heart Shaped Box on the radio in the studio, in the restaurant. And she jumped up and yelled, "Albini on the radio! It's Albini on the radio!" So, you know, and I'm sure a bunch of people looked up and said, "What the hell does that mean?" You know, and who is this? But, you know, so we didn't, I don't remember going out much.
Okay.
You know, we pretty much would, you know, they'd go home and we'd stay late and work at the studio. So,
A couple questions about Courtney as a musician in some of you're working with. And, I only really ask this for my own personal taste. I think the answer's got to be yes, but she actually plays on the record as far as a guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she's not known as a great guitar player, but they are her songs, and so.
A lot of times, what you hear is her starting the song, kind of like kicking it off, like the beginning of a song would be her, and then other things would come in the song and take over. But I'm not sure she's playing guitar on every song.
Okay.
But most of them, I think.
Was it easy to get a good vocal from her, or was it something that was kind of like, because you said you kind of pieced in some crap from the demos and stuff?
Well, like I said, a good scream is precious, you know. We did a lot of takes, but again, you know, like I went to a Linda Ronstadt studio session, and they, you know, she did 24 takes of a vocal on a, you know, in a song, you know,
okay,
takes. And you know, I don't know if they were all good or some were good, but they had a careful map of all the things that, you know, this word from here, this word from there, this word from there. So, you know, we were determined to get really good vocals. And so if we didn't have something, we went back and did it again. You know, we didn't just on that record for sure. We didn't say like, all right, that's good enough, or we don't have time, you know.
And she was like, wasn't like, fuck you or anything like that. She's like, okay, let's do it again.
Sometimes.
Okay, sometimes she was, okay.
Again, you know, you got to choose the right time to say, hey, you know, can you just go do one more of those, you know, there's a couple of lines we like to get, you know. And we didn't, you know, it wasn't a trick. We were just basically like, we got a couple of things we don't feel like we have.
Right,
yet, you
no.
know? And she kind of trusted us. Like if we said we didn't have it, she didn't go, let me hear all the choices and I'll decide that. You know, she
all
was.
All right,
that was
fair cool. enough.
That was cool, you know. Like she would say, like, "Okay, you tell me. I don't want to listen to everything." You know.
What about as an individual who's definitely the artistic vision for everything, and of course a very domineering presence? What was she like to work with? Was it easy to communicate with her back and forth? Like when she wanted to make a point to you, was it a lot of give and take, or how? What was the relationship like there? Is what I'm getting at.
It wasn't bad, you know. She would change things up sometimes, you know, like we'd be going along and she'd say, no, wait, I don't want to do it that way, you know. And sometimes that would cause us to have to, you know, redo something, or, you know, but generally she would only do that if she generally did make it better.
Okay.
You know, like, so, and that's something that Sean really believed in, I know, is like, if you know, if you're going to make, if you're going to change something, it's got to be better. You know, you can't just change it because you change your mind. So, but we, I think she realized that if we, you know, if we could agree that something was better and there's a better way to do it, that we would do it and not grumble about it or anything. You know, we didn't get mad because we had to do something over. And, you know, sometimes we try something and we agree that it wasn't better and we go back to the old way. So, you know, she wasn't unfair about stuff like that. She didn't order us around or, you know, and we tried to listen and be good producers. You know, that's what being a good producer is. You know, you don't, it's not your vision. You know, you're trying to get this person's vision out, you know, so that was our job.
I assume you are two different kind of people. Were there times where it was like, this is more for you to talk to Courtney, Sean, versus times where it was like, this is the kind of thing that Paul will talk to Courtney on?
Oh, yeah, maybe. We were almost
always. Or anybody in the band.
We were almost always there together.
Okay.
You know, I mean, as far as our team with me and Sean, you know, I was probably a little bit more handling the engineering, you know, and he would handle a little bit more arrangement type of thing, you know?
Hmm.
And so, yeah, there might be a sound question that would sort of be to me. And if there was an arrangement question, that might be more to Sean, you know. Everybody was kind of burnt out at the end of that stint, you know. So after that, there was some mixing. Scott Litt did some mixes. And I think Jay Maskus.
Yeah, that's the Dinosaur Jr. guy, right?
Yeah.
What the hell? Is that his thing? Was he just like this great mixer or something?
No, the guy who actually, the engineer was Tim O'Hare, who was another one of the Fort Apache guys.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why she wanted him to do it. It was funny because we got that mix that came in very late, and we literally like flew to the airport. We drove to the airport. It was the day that we were going to master the record with Bob Ludwig up in Portland, Maine. And so we're in Boston. We drive to the airport. We meet Tim, who's flying wherever the hell they did that mix. I don't remember where that was. And so he handed us the mix on tape, and we got in the car and we drove up to Portland. Sean and I drove up to Portland through this unbelievable thunderstorm. It was just raging, crazy. We were looking at each other like, are we going to make it? And we got up there and the sun was shining and we mastered the record. And we hadn't even heard the mix when we gave it to Bob, you know? So, yikes.
Do you prefer to have someone else mix the record? That always seems odd to me that a producer wants to step out, but you're not the first person who's done that, obviously.
Yeah, I've been on all sides of it. I've been the guy who had his record given to someone else, and I've been the guy who's had someone else's record given to him, you know? It's just a job. Sometimes the A&R people like to have control, so they divide the job up into different people so they can control who gets what part of the job. And it all has to go through them. That happens. In this case, that really wasn't Mark's thing. I think I think Kurt and Courtney, you know, Scott Litt had mixed some things on In Utero, and they liked his work. So, you know, he did a good job. And, you know, and they asked, I mean, they had asked him to do a number of songs. And I think there was some of them, in particular Doll Parts, where he said, no, I don't want to mix that. The mix they did is good.
Nice.
So, it was, in a way, you'd be hard-pressed to tell which mixes are his. It's all kind of one thing.
I do think it's kind of a consistent-sounding record, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that's just because of the way we recorded it, you know? There wasn't much, and there wasn't a lot of trickery in the mixing, you know? It was just mixed the way it was recorded. So, Scott wasn't a guy who was, he was a pretty straightforward mixer too, much the same way that we were. So, I think it just made them feel better. Like they just weren't sure, you know. By the end of the mixing in Atlanta, everybody was just kind of frazzled, and I think, you know, there was some, you know, why not try? Let's try having someone else mix it, you know.
Okay.
I think we went back and even did some more back up in Boston. I can't remember. There was a sort of an amorphous period there when it all sort of came together. And like I said, the last mix on the record came in the day before mastering, which is literally the last minute. So,
Yeah, right. That's the last stage. So,
yeah.
Well, of course, Paul, the record is released just about a week after Kurt's suicide, which is not something. Look, it just couldn't be. You can't really pre-plan that unless you believe some of the mythology there. But was there, to your knowledge, I guess is the best way to put this, was there any talk of delaying the release?
I wasn't involved in anything like that. You know, that's Geffen.
I kind of figured, I mean, at that point, you've already kind of, walked away from the project and turned to your...
It's out of our hands. Yeah, we were doing something else by then. I know Mark, and I've never really even asked him that question. I never heard anybody say, we wanted to postpone it or anything. I think they just went ahead and put it out. I don't know if they thought it was going to work for them.
It might have been too late. These things might have been in boxes on, because record stores get these things a little bit early. But
A week out means it's on the trucks, heading to.
Yeah.
They can't really. There's no reason to stop it.
And then almost unintendedly, the album title takes on a whole new meaning, which was never intended. Like I said, unintendedly. I think that adds into some of the, I don't know, just the not. Let me just. Have you seen or you had to have heard of it? Have you seen the docudrama about the whole theory that Courtney had Kurt killed?
It's the one that's called Kurt and Courtney or something.
Something like that. I mean, I've seen it. I can't remember the name of it. I'm sorry that I'm kind of bringing it up because we're at the stage here, but so I didn't really prepare for that question, but I did watch it. But it's very it's a very one sided deal. But
yeah. They don't. I don't know. I really know nothing about it. Well, again, we were completely out of the picture.
You say you never saw the movie? Is all I'm asking.
I've seen the movie. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, only because people are going to be upset if I brought up and didn't ask. Do you think Kurt? I can't even believe it. You don't think she had him killed, do you?
I just have no comment.
Fair enough.
I know nothing about that.
It's so speculative. All right, moving on. How about this? What do you think about the record looking back? Is it as far as your career, how do you look at it?
I think it's a good example of to me, there's a sort of a Zen thing about recording.
Mm-hmm.
In order to win, you must lose. You must give up. And then you can truly be victorious.
Wow.
And it happened with Radiohead on their second record. They had tried to make this over again, and they tried to mix it, and they got to the point where they were just, Ed told me they were just defeated. They said, this record has ruined us. It's finished us. And somebody said, well, why don't you send some mixes? Why don't you send some songs over to America? And, then we started hitting them one by one, and all of a sudden things turned around, because they got outside their thing. But they had given up. They were, and so I was like that with this record. At the end of it, I was so, I was beaten by the whole process, and we got ourselves home, and I walked into my apartment, and my girlfriend said, well, how's the record? What's going on? How is it? I don't know, here. And I threw her a cassette, and she drove to work, and she came back from work, and she said, it's awesome. And I said, it is? Because I didn't think it was bad. I just didn't know. I just felt like, I don't know if this is even good. I really don't know.
Like, you're just too involved in it to really separate yourself from, how good it might be.
It's happened, and like I said, it's happened several times in my career. Luckily for me, in a way, because you get into something and you do it, and you're just completely in the moment of doing it, and you're not saying this is going to be great or this is going to be the first single or, we just did the best we could, and we felt like, man, I hope I did everything I could do, did I leave it all out there? And then all of a sudden things started turning around, I went to. The year it came out, I went to a Halloween party out in Provincetown, and I was in a bar with, 250 or 300 lesbians mostly, and they were played Violet on the bar over the sound system, which was a good sound system in this bar, and when they got to to the end of the first line, the whole, everybody in the bar started screamed along with that line. You should learn how to say no. Like the entire bar. And I turned around and looked at the people I was with, and I was like, wow. You know,
that had to feel good, man.
That's what I mean. It's like when you, that's true success in the music producing world, is if you punch something into culture, mm-hmm. so that people take a record and make it part of their life. And so, if you know what I think about that record, it's pretty much the same now. Is that, you know, it's got legs, you know, because it's a true record, you know. It's a real rock record, I think. I'm proud of it, and I'm glad that people still listen to it.
Well, I'll pat you on the back a little bit. On from a production standpoint, especially, it has aged masterfully. It sounds as good then as it would hold up now. Like so, well done is all I'm getting at.
Well, it's the number four best grunge record of all time.
Yeah, so. Now that is that is one thing, like going through this, that people have like, that is one of the most debatable positions on this list. Yeah. I was not a fan. I really only dug into this record for this list. Right. And it really changed my opinion of Courtney, because, you know, let's just say I didn't have a very positive view, but now I at least kind of have a little more respect for her. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Going through this, and talking to you has only kind of backed that up. So I really appreciate that. But everybody seems to think that, they get this album belongs on the list. They just think four might be a little high. What do you think four is the proper spot?
Well,
Are you too biased to judge?
I don't know. You know, honestly, I've had, you know, it's been on a lot of lists, mm-hmm. and it's been in different positions on the list. And I think, you know, these lists all reflect the prejudices of the.
Well, and they're kind of clickbaity too at times, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, is OK Computer the greatest rock record of all time? Well, it's pretty good. You know, okay. I don't know. certainly Nirvana is going to be number one on the list, and Pearl Jam has to be number two. Sure. I thought Soundgarden at number three was kind of an odder choice than Hole at number four.
That's a hot take.
You know, I what is grunge? You know, that's the thing. Like, is Live Through This really grunge? I guess it is. In a way, like, you'd rate it lower just because it isn't really a true, you know. Hmm. I mean, it's not like a Monster Magnet record, or, you know, or a Mudhoney record, or, you know, I don't know.
Well, so, I actually have an explanation for that. If you like, to me, grunge is like what you're talking about, that kind of Mudhoney, almost Melvins kind of thing. But the fact of the matter is that when Nirvana broke out of the grunge scene, because I don't even think Nirvana necessarily could be, you can make the argument that they weren't really grunge either. But grunge in Seattle were all definitely tied together, and that whole scene was. And when that blew up, it had a spillover kind of umbrella effect, and that definitely helped bands like Hole, Stone Temple Pilots, the handful of bands on this list that aren't from Seattle were all drawn in because of that you could argue aren't grunge. Screaming Trees sound kind of more classic rock, but the fact of the matter is, unlike any other scene that had this kind of diverse thing, the one core element drew in a lot of things that it helped bands like Belly, who you produced, you know what I mean? The Lemonheads.
I think that the people making this list, they've got to be a little bit PC, you know, like they got to get a woman in there, and, you know, who's going to make the top 10, you know, like from, you know, it's politically, it makes sense to put it where it is, I guess. I don't know. I think that that one thing about Live Through This is it's kind of been coming on strong. Like recently, like last year or something, Pitchfork gave it a posthumous 10. You know, I mean, what gets a 10 from Pitchfork? You know, if Jesus Christ came back and made a record, he probably would get a 9.2.
A few weeks back, when I knew this record was coming up, before I even reached out to you, and I got to sit down and listen to this, I looked at the song list and I thought Doll Parts was the only song I knew. Yeah. And the first three tracks, I'm like, I know all these songs by heart. So I was like, I had totally kind of forgotten how much of this album actually permeated what was going on at the time. So,
yeah. Well, like I said, that's always our goal. And to achieve that is, you know, what I'm striving for always, and still am, but it's harder than ever.
And again, I wanted to echo from a production standpoint, I love the drum sound too. I think, look, that everything starts there with production, I think, from...
That's true.
And, you get a good drum sound because you can hear everything, and it's nice, and the performance is, you know, great takes and all that stuff, so...
Yeah. Well, that's a little shout-out to our drum tech, Carl Flaster.
Oh, nice.
For that one. He was someone who was there throughout all our golden era, and always did a great job. Very dedicated and very talented.
Do you have any nerdy techniques you'd like to share as far as like recording drums, or you just take it different each time?
It really depends on the drummer. You know, it's how they play and how they set up and how many drums they use, and you know, it's not. Drums are actually not as hard to record as people think. I think that the hardest thing to do is to get great vocals.
You know, okay.
Not so much sonically as just something that, you know, like, can you get something that people want to listen to?
I know what you're saying there, man.
Yeah.
Well, how about this? Do you have any favorite tracks looking back?
Doll Parts, because that was when I heard that demo, it's happened to me a few times in my life where someone played me a demo and I was just like bowled over. I just was like, wait a minute, I got to make that record. You know, I want to make that record. And we did, and it came out great. And there's some cool things about it. One thing that's cool nerd wise about that song is that at the end, when the song lifts up, it's actually cut in from a different take and we were using a different snare drum, and you can hear the difference, but it works like it's something that I wouldn't have planned. But it works really well, and I've done it again since, you know, where you switch drums, you know, you don't the same drums are not from the beginning to the end of the track, you know. And
I've never heard that before. That's amazing.
And I cut it, you know, it just lifted it up, and it was a happy accident.
And this is pre-Pro Tools again, so you're actually out there with the little piece of chalk and the razor blade.
Grease pencil and a razor blade.
Grease pencil, I'm sorry. I've seen it done. I cannot believe how... I need somebody to sit down with me and go, here we go, we're going to do it. I have to see it. I don't get it.
Well, it's just splicing tape. I was good at it. That was one of my big skills.
Clearly.
Well, that's because it allows you to be creative, because you don't have to have one perfect take from beginning to end. You can, once the band figures out that they can do the ending, just the end, you know,
right.
That's like a big deal.
Well, Paul, you have been amazing. The stories you shared have been great. I really appreciate your time. I'm glad you agreed to do this. You've definitely been an asset to everything we're doing here. Is there anything you need to plug as far as what you're doing? You're still recording people, right?
Yes, I do a lot of mixing here at my home, and just mixed the Jayhawks record that was actually recorded at...
Oh, another Minnesota band.
Yep, and Gary Lewis's solo record's about to come out. I actually just heard a test pressing of that today, and it's great. I recommend it. So I'll plug that for you.
Right, nice.
Well, for me, I don't have any points on it, but it's a great record.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for your time, and I appreciate it. You have a good night.
You too.
I'm not afraid to
The pronunciation of your last name is Coldery. Am I getting that right?
Coldery.
Coldery. Okay. I want to get it right.
Fair enough. It's been, you know, I'm dealing with that my whole life. So.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.